everyone. Thank you so much for coming. I can't believe this is our last Sunday morning together. I really enjoyed learning with everyone over the course of the year. Today we're going to learn about Rabbi Akiva, because right now we're in the middle of the period of Sfirat HaOmer, and Rabbi Akiva is very connected to the story of Sfirat HaOmer. If you look at the first, what we're going to do generally is talk about why we're learning about Rabbi Akiva today, look a little bit at Rabbi Akiva's background, his story, how he became the rabbi we know and love, and then look at a character trait of his that comes across in many different areas of his life, and that's his optimism. We've been talking about models of leadership. We've been talking about things that you need to be a leader, and Rabbi Akiva seems to have, you know, this one trait of optimism that shines through when he's in conversation with other people, and I think that influences the way we see him. It also might influence the way we see the period of Sfirat HaOmer. So, the Gemara in Masechet Yevamot says, oh, this is the first time we're doing a character not from the period of Tanakh. So, just a little bit to get ourselves in the right place historically. Star sheets are here. We can... Yeah. All right, if we could just pass those down. Rabbi Akiva lived... in the generation immediately after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. The second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed by the Romans in the year 70 CE. Rabbi Akiva lived through that, but his main time period was the period after that, leading through the rebellion of Bar Kokhba, which was a rebellion against the Romans about 60 years later, if I'm correct. And so very something we have to pay a lot of attention to is how his leadership is very connected to the fact that this is the first generation of Jews living without a temple, whose lives have been completely changed because the center of their religious focus used to be sacrifices, used to be the Kohanim sort of doing actions for them, and suddenly they're faced with a very different way of living religiously. So we'll keep all of that information in the back of our minds, if possible. And jump into why Rabbi Akiva has to do with the period of Sfirat HaOmer. So, the Gemara in Masechet Yevamot says, and I'll be reading on the Hebrew side, but you're welcome to follow along in English, of course. Amru, Shnei Masar Elef Zugim Talmidim Hayu Lo L'Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students. So how many students is that actually? 24,000, but they're described in pairs. They were Migeved Ad Antipras, all over the country, v'kulan metu b'perak achad mibnei shelo nehagu kavod zelazeh, and they all died during one period because they did not respect each other enough. Now we could have an entire shiur on what was going on. You know, what did they do wrong? How is it exactly that they died? But that's not really what we're focusing on today. The important part is that the Gemara continues, Tana kulam metu mi Pesach v'arat Tzaret. They all died in the period between Pesach and Shavuot. And that's why the Shulchan Aruch says, Nohagim shelo lisa isha bein Pesach la'at Tzaret ad lag ba'omer, mipnei shebeoto zman metu talmidei Rabbi Akiva. Our tradition is that we do not have weddings between Pesach and Shavuot because that's when Rabbi Akiva's students died. And this idea of lag ba'omer is also something that if we had a whole nother series, we would discuss the history of Lag BaOmer and how that became sort of a holiday.
Historically, it's because of when Magishva.
Okay, so the Gemara does say that, but there are plenty of people who would say, 24,000 people exactly all died because of this plague, and we don't hear anything else about it. It's definitely possible, and that's definitely, the straight reading. But the important part for us is just that this is why we're reading about Rabbi Akiva today, and in fact, we're going to come back to this story at the very end. But now I want to look at Rabbi Akiva's background. We have source sheets over here. If people need, we can just pass those along down. So Rabbi Akiva's life story is a rags-to-riches story in two ways, both literally and metaphorically. What I mean is that Rabbi Akiva did not grow up davening at UOS and going to Baron Academy and then decided to go to yeshiva for a year after 12th grade and then decided to go on and get smicha. He did not grow up in the way that we expect someone to grow up and be the greatest rabbi of his whole generation. In fact, Rabbi Akiva himself describes his relationship with Torah when he was younger. If you look at the next source, the Gemara says in Psachim, Tanya Amar Rabbi Akiva, Kshehayiti Am Haaretz Amarti, Mi Yitainli Talmid Chacham Va'anashchenu Kechamor. Rabbi Akiva tells his students, back in the olden days, when I was an Am Haaretz, when I was an ignoramus, when I knew no Torah, it wasn't just that I didn't know any Torah, I also hated Torah scholars, and I used to say, if I could find a Torah scholar, I would, the English translation here translates, maul him like an ass, okay? Basically, you know, the worst thing you could think of, I would just beat up all the Talmidei Chacham if I could find them. Okay, this is not a guy who just was ignorant. This is a guy who did not have a positive view of Torah scholarship at all. But he eventually did grow into being Rabbi Akiva. Here's a source sheet. We're going to look at this source next. There are two varying sources that tell us the story of how Rabbi Akiva began to learn Torah. We're going to look at both of them. They obviously, we have to go in knowing, they can't both be literally true exactly this, exactly, because they contradict each other. If that's going to upset you, you have to put that aside, because we're looking to understand the rationale. What are the stories trying to tell us about Rabbi Akiva's influence for going to learn Torah, and what literally happened, what he wrote down in his journal at the end of the day, that's not what we're trying to figure out, okay? So the first story is told to us in Masechet Ketubot. Tells us, we'll actually look at this one in English, just because the Hebrew is actually Aramaic, and it'll take a long time to translate. So we'll look at this one in English. It says, Rabbi Akiva was a shepherd of Ben Kalba Savua. Ben Kalba Savua, he was a very, very rich guy who lived in Yerushalayim. Rabbi Akiva was a shepherd, and Kalba Savua's daughter saw that Rabbi Akiva was a modest guy, a noble guy, a really good guy. She saw that he had potential. So she said to him, if we got married, would you go learn Torah? This is a guy who obviously, you know, he has a job. He has a pretty stable life. And this girl shows up and says, let's totally change it around. I think that you would be good if you managed to learn some Torah. So let's get married, and you could go learn. And he says, all right. I could try that, you know, I never had the opportunity before, I can't turn this down. Now, does anybody know, what was Rabbi Akiva's daughter's name?
His daughter or his wife?
Sorry, Rabbi Akiva's wife's name.
Rachel.
Okay, so it doesn't say that in this text, but yes, the character we're talking about has the same name as me, so I always get a little bit excited. In this story, she sends him off to go learn Torah, okay? But the story gets more complicated because as soon as Kalba Savua hears that his daughter has married this poor shepherd, he kicks her out of the house, and he does something even more drastic. He makes a vow that she can never receive any benefit from anything that he owns. Not only is she kicked out of the house, but he can't, you know, she can't come over for dinner, she can't, you know, borrow anything, you know, nobody can give her presents from the household. Really totally cut off. And she lives in poverty while Rabbi Akiva is off studying for 12 years. Hey?
So you're going to say that she changed him?
Well, let's get to the end of the story.
Okay.
Let's get to the end of the story, and then we'll decide if that seems right. Okay? So Rabbi Akiva goes off to learn for 12 years. He comes home at the end of 12 years, and he overhears his wife say to a neighbor, you know, the neighbor is being mean. If you look at it, okay. We're in the line where he heard an old man saying to her, how long will you lead the life of a living widowhood? Right? He says to poor Rachel, you're living by yourself. It's like you're a widow, but your husband is still alive. And she responds, if he would listen to me, he would spend another 12 years studying. So Rabbi Akiva hears that his wife is okay with this. He goes back to study, and 12 years later, he comes back to town with 24,000 students. Okay? The mathematical aspect is basically trying to show us that in these 24 years, Rabbi Akiva has gone from nothing to the leader of the generation. To the extent that he comes home and Rachel tries to go and see him, and his students are all pushing her away. What are you, this poor woman, trying to come speak to our rabbi? And what happens if we flip the page? This we're actually going to read in Hebrew because it's a really beautiful phrase. So, if you want to follow along in Hebrew, we're on the 1, 2, 3, the fourth line in the right column on page 2. But you can also follow along in English. Rabbi Akiva says to his students, Amar lehu, shavkuha, sheli v'shelachem, shelahu. He says to students, leave her alone, because everything I have and everything you have is all hers. All the Torah that we know, all of the greatness that we've achieved because of the Torah that we've learned, it is all entirely because of her. Now, this is the rags to riches metaphorically story. Rabbi Akiva starts out poor, knowing no Torah. He has no wife. Come to the end of the story, he has both a wife and basically all the Torah anybody could ever ask for. But they're still pretty poor. The story also ties that up neatly. What happens is, Kalba Savua heard that a great man was coming to town, and he said, you know, I'd like to get out of this vow, this promise I made, that my daughter can never, you know, have any benefit from my possessions, because it seems kind of harsh. So he goes to this rabbi, who he does not know is actually his son-in-law, and Rabbi Akiva says to him, would you have made your vow if you knew that your daughter was marrying a guy who would turn out to be a pretty great guy? And Kalba Savua says, if I thought that this guy would learn even one halacha, if I thought that he would have the potential to learn any Torah, I never would have made this vow. So Rabbi Akiva says, all right, you're absolved from your vow. By the way, hi, I'm Akiva, your son-in-law. And then Kalba Savua gave Rabbi Akiva and Rachel 50% of his wealth. Okay, so at the end of the story now, Rabbi Akiva has Torah, a wife, and money. Okay? It's the perfect, you know, it's a perfect story from a narrative perspective, right? It goes through the arc of a whole story. And at the end, we have this positive resolution, okay? So in this story, how did Rabbi Akiva start learning Torah? It's because of?
His wife.
It's because of his wife. And it's not just that it sounds like it's because of his wife. We hear from his own mouth, right? He gives her all of the credit in the world, okay? We don't know anything about the Torah that Rabbi Akiva actually learned in this story. Right? This story is focused a little bit more on externals, right? We have the rich and we have the poor. We have no students, 12,000 students, 24,000 students. This story is a great story to be performed, right? It's a story that shows you, that gives you a picture, right? You have a woman who's poor, and she's going to try to reach her husband, and the students are pushing her away, right? And her husband says, no, you know, she really deserves to be honored. So I think this story is perfect because it's just such a great story. You see what I'm saying? Right? It gives this narrative in exactly the way you want to hear the background of a story. The next story is a smaller story. It's more personal, and it tells us more about the content of what Rabbi Akiva learned, rather than the outward, the way people saw it. Okay, the second story is told in Avot Rabbi Natan, which is not in the Gemara Mishnah, written a little bit later, but also part of that same time period of texts. And it starts with the question, Mahaya tchilato shel Rabbi Akiva. How did Rabbi Akiva start out? And it tells us, Amru ben arba'im shana haya velo shana klum. Rabbi Akiva was 40 years old and had never learned anything. Okay, we didn't know in the previous story how old was Rabbi Akiva when he started learning Torah. Here we hear he's 40 years old. He's not, you know, he's not 20, he's not 30, right? This is 40 years, especially in Jewish sources, 40 years is like a guy who's lived, you know, a significant chunk of life. I mean, also in real life, but in Judaic sources, 40 years is sort of is seen as a generation. Not a lifetime, but time that if you're starting over, it's very, very significant. Okay? So he's 40 years old, and what causes him to start learning Torah? Something that he sees. Pam achat haya omed al pi ha-be'er. He was standing next to a well. Amar Michakak Evenzu says, who carved this stone? How is it that I see a stone that has a hole in the middle of it? Where did this hole come from? And everybody standing there says, Amrulo, Hamaim Shetzadir no flim alaha bechol yom. They said, water is constantly dripping on this stone, and eventually the water made a hole. And in fact they continued, Amrulo Akiva, Iatakore Avanim Shaku Maim. There's a pasuk in the I think it's actually from Eov. And says, don't you know, the verse even tells us that stones can be washed away by water. So what does Rabbi Akiva do? This small little conversation has a massive influence on the way Rabbi Akiva thinks. Because he says, Miyad haya Rabbi Akiva dan kal vachomer ba'atzmo. Rabbi Akiva started making a comparison. He said, Ma rach pasal hakasheh, just like something that's soft, water, can carve away at something that's hard, a rock. Divrei Torah shekashin kibarzel, alacha kama v'kama shiach kaku et libi, shehu basar v'adam. Certainly, the words of Torah, which are hard, can definitely carve away at my heart, which is only made of flesh. He says, you know, maybe up until now I thought that I could never learn Torah. It was out of reach for me. But if this little water can carve away this stone, I must have the potential. I must not be completely lost. Let's see where it can go. So this, I think, is a beautiful scene. It says, Miyab chazar lomod Torah. Rabbi Akiva goes to learn Torah. If you're 40 years old and you've never learned Torah before, where do you go? What? Okay, so now there are plenty of institutions that help people who've never learned Torah before who want to learn, okay? But now we're not just talking about a guy who never learned Torah. Rabbi Akiva also can't read at all, right? He's never gone to school. We're talking about a society where not everybody was even literate. So Rabbi Akiva goes to school. Suddenly we hear that Rabbi Akiva has a son. Halachu ubno v'yashvu etzel melamdei tinokot. He took his son to first grade. Amarlo, Rebbe, lamdeini Torah. He says to the teacher, teach me Torah, right? I'm coming to first grade with my son, and I want to learn. Achaz, Rabbi Akiva, Barosh Haloach, Ubno Barosh Haloach. Rabbi Akiva and his son sat next to each other. Right? They were both holding, like, the board, I think, where you started practicing to write letters. Katavlo, Aleph, Bet, Vilamda. Aleph, Tav, Vilamda. The teacher taught him to read the Aleph, Bet, all of the letters, Aleph through Tav. Torah Kohanim v'lamda, he taught him the Sefer Vayikra. Hayalomid v'holeich ad shalamad kol haTorah kula. Rabbi Akiva continues sitting in school with the children until he's learned everything that he can learn with the children. And then he goes. He's not done. Just because he graduated, you know, 8th grade or whatever it is, he doesn't think that he's learned enough. Halach v'yashavlo lifnei Rabbi Eliezer v'Rabbi Hoshua. He goes to Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, who were the two leading sages of the time, the two greatest teachers of Torah. Amar lahem rabotai pitchu li ta'am mishnah. He says to them, teach me halacha. Teach me the deeper understandings of Torah. Teach me more than just what I know. Kevan she'amru lo halacha achat, they taught him one halacha, one law. Halach v'yashav lo beino levein atzmo. Rabbi Akiva goes to sit by himself once he's heard just this one halacha. Amar, alef zo lama nechtava, bet zo lama nechtava, davar ze lama ne'amar. He goes and he looks at the words, and we're talking about laws that were derived from psukim, from verses in the Torah. So he goes, he looks at the pasuk, and he says, so this letter in the pasuk, why is it here? This letter in the pasuk, why is it here? How is all of this connected to the words that I see in front of me in the pasuk, and how do I get from there to the halacha that I know? Okay? This story is different from the previous story in a couple of ways. Let's just throw some of them out there.
Makes a bit more sense that he's got his son, and that after he's been married, I mean, why would he leave his new wife and go for 12 years and not have children and whatever?
Okay, so from a biographic perspective, it makes sense that he would start learning, you know, with his child. The implication, though, is that, you know, he married Rachel still as a complete ignoramus, right? Rachel is absent from this story, but in this story, she marries a guy who can't read, and she can't convince him to go learn. You know, she doesn't play an active role in this story. In this story, there's also, it's not 0 to 60, right? Rabbi Akiva doesn't go away and then come back with tons of students, right? Here we see the process. We see that he had to learn to read, and he had to learn a little bit of Torah, and only, you know, once he learned to read could he get to all these other great heights. What else do we see in this story that we didn't see in the previous one? Anything?
He was older when he started.
Okay, we know how old he was. In the previous story, he could have been a young guy. Here we know that he was at least 40, right? In this story, we have a little bit more of an understanding of what was preventing him from learning Torah up until now. We have a little bit more of a psychological sense of Rabbi Akiva, that moment that, you know, that he realizes that if water can wash away stone, so maybe I can still learn Torah. What that teaches us, if he needed that moment, it means that for now, that up until then, he knew that Torah was out there, but he didn't think that he could do it, right?
Excuse me, it says, Chazar l'ilmot Torah, after he saw the thing, which means that before that he was already was learning.
No, so
why does it say, after he heard it, Chazar, he returned and...
So if you know somebody who grew up not religious, and then they become religious, in Hebrew, what do you call that? He's Chozer b'tshuva, okay? There's this idea that's actually linguistically an interesting idea that people can return somewhere that they never actually were. That you, I'm relatively sure, look, it is possible that in this story you could understand that maybe when he was a child, Rabbi Akiva had, you know, tried to learn Torah and it hadn't worked out. I think that the story is telling us that he had never learned anything and suddenly thinks, I'll return to my roots, I'll return to, you know, the general Jewish population and maybe begin to learn. Yeah, Alan?
Well, I mean, I know that it's probably a midrash, but the whole concept that, you know, we learn all of Torah when we're in the womb, and then as we're born, that we forget it.
Oh, that's a great idea.
I mean,
that
the fact that, in a certain sense, I think every person has it within them, and certain things will, like, really kick that into gear or cause you to, you know, want to pursue that and... know that you can get there.
Right. Okay, that's another really good way of potentially reading, you know, the idea of being chozer, of returning to something that you didn't actually come from. If we assume that everybody, you know, has learned at some point and is about accessing that, so I think that that does add a level to this Rabbi Akiva character. That
Neshama is part of Hashem. Like, you are coming back to it.
Right.
Maybe in this earthly world, you don't have that knowledge of yourself and that part of yourself. But it's just there. It's just like outside of our human unearthed experience.
Okay, so that's one way of seeing it. Hold on, I want to hear Neda, and then I'll hear from Luis. Yeah.
It seems to me in a room full of women, we should be leaning towards the first story, talking about how important it is that the women and his love for this one woman inspired him to go on and study, and how supportive and everything she was of him in his ability.
So you like seeing Rachel as being the catalyst for all of the learning.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Yeah.
It's the idea that he would go away for 12 years.
I'm somewhat.
Without her inspiration, you wouldn't.
Right. It's a somewhat conflicting story because, on the one hand, Rachel is, you know, he says, everything I have is because of Rachel. I would have learned no Torah without her. On the other hand, she had to sit home and be a, you know, a living widow for 24 years. So how much of it is a modern lesson?
I think it's,
you know, it's difficult, yeah. But yes, in terms of, you know, the inspiration, I definitely think there's a lot there. But somebody wanted
to... She really wanted to learn on her own, but couldn't because she was a woman. You know?
Okay, maybe there's that.
I mean, I know that story, but I always thought that by saying that, it meant that he spent long hours learning, but I'm sure they spent time together. They didn't actually not see each other.
Right. So it doesn't need to mean that for 24 years they never saw each other, especially if we know that there's a child involved. So certainly... Right. In fact, this story of Rabbi Akiva comes in the middle of a whole list of stories in the Gemara about men who left their wives to go learn Torah and often were punished for it. There's a whole list of stories of a guy who, you know, he said he would come back and then he didn't come back and he fell off a roof and died. That's an extreme example. Basically, the Gemara in Ketubot is trying to figure out what's the proper balance between going away to learn Torah if that's necessary and spending time with your family, which is also a value that the Gemara actually acknowledges. It's not a modern reading that we're throwing onto the Gemara. The Gemara actually does value that. On the other hand, it doesn't tell us about any return visits that Rabbi Akiva made, right? It allows us to see this sacrificing Rachel as someone who almost never saw her husband. So how did it practically work out? Not clear. But I think that you're right, that it doesn't need to be as extreme as that. Yeah, Louise?
I still don't see where he went from someone who would... If he saw a rabbi, he would kick him like a dog to the 24,000 students. One, you know, one woman that he married and then never lives with, that's enough.
Okay, so there's, so there, I think that the inspiration in the first story, I think that what the first story is trying to tell us is the power of someone believing in you, right? In the first story, Rachel, this rich girl, sees a shepherd, right? He has never done anything, you know, bigger than being a shepherd in his life. And she tells him, I believe in you enough that I want you to go try, right? I think that from that perspective, it's saying that Rabbi Akiva had, you know, a negative perspective because he never had the opportunity to learn. I think it's trying to say that somebody who is shut out from educational opportunities becomes hateful of people who have those opportunities. Because if you can't access something, so you become hateful of the people who have access to it, and you denigrate them, and you say, oh, they're not so great, right? And so I think that that's actually part of the story, is that saying once he was given somebody who believed in him, and once he was given access, turns out his whole hatred of it was really baseless. I think we all know his hatred of Talmidei Chachamim had no particular base in, you know, it doesn't say that I saw Talmidei Chachamim doing bad things. It was just I was brought up with this negative perspective of them. But suddenly, once he was given access, I think that says a lot about access to education and faith that people have in you in terms of the achievements that you're able to get to. But all of this was just how Rabbi Akiva got to where he was. But I want to look at what happened when he got there. Because Rabbi Akiva has a perspective on things that's unique among all other rabbis of his time. And we're going to start with a relatively famous story about him, which is what happens when Rabbi Akiva goes traveling. Okay, the source is in Aramaic on the bottom of page 2. We'll look at it. I'll just tell it. Everyone can read inside in whatever language they prefer. Rabbi Akiva is traveling along, and he gets to a city. And he asks, can somebody put me up for the night? And everybody says no. Rabbi Akiva says, the phrase that's very important is, Kol man da'avid rachmana, everything that God does, litav avid, he does it for the best. It's similar to the phrase more people might know, gamzu latova, this too is for the best. Rabbi Akiva always, always said this. So, nobody offers to put him up for the night. He says, this too is for the best, it'll work out. So he goes to sleep in the open field. Rabbi Akiva has three things with him. He has a candle, he has a donkey, and he has a rooster. Okay, candle to help him see, donkey get from place to place, and the rooster maybe as an alarm clock, or just because he's traveling with a rooster. So he gets to the field, he starts to get himself comfortable. A wind comes and blows out the candle, and then suddenly wild animals come and they kill the donkey and they eat the rooster. And now he's left in the pitch black dark, no way to get anywhere, no rooster to wake him up in the morning. He lies down and he says, Kol man da'avid rachmana litav avid, everything God does, it must be for the best. He goes to sleep. When he wakes up in the morning, he finds out that a troop of brigands, of kidnappers really, have come through the town and they've taken everybody in the town hostage. He says, if I had been sleeping there, I would have been taken. If I had had a candle that they could see or animals that they could hear, they would have taken me too. That's why you always have to say, Kol man da'avid rachmana litav avid. Everything that God does, it really works out for the best. Now, I don't know anybody, I think, although maybe there's someone in this room, who if you were sleeping in the field and you lost your candle and your donkey and your rooster, you would say, everything God does is for the best. I'd like to think that there are people like that out there. There really must be. I don't know any of them. Okay? Oh, good. Okay, you know one. So in this room, somebody knows somebody who looks at the world like this.
After we heard that the disaster happened.
No, so that's not true. He said it before.
What?
Yeah, that's the point of the story.
Who
the
heard
point
it?
Of this? What?
Who heard it?
Nobody was leaving. So
who heard it? Okay, so you're saying it might be that, you know, that it's a post facto story. But the point of this is that it's relatively easy after the fact to say, oh, now I understand why all of this happened. But to say it in the midst of something awful happening to you, that's a really big challenge. And this is a talent that Rabbi Akiva had, and it was a talent that was necessary, as I said, in the generation after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Because Jews were very used to a certain way of performing their religion, and suddenly they're lost. There are two holidays especially that I think the Jews were feeling rather lost. And they came up to those holidays and didn't have a Beit HaMikdash. Any guesses on what those holidays are? Okay, Tisha B'Av is the day when they remember what had happened, but what's the day that what they did in the Beit HaMikdash was so central? Okay, Yom Kippur, a day that everything was done in the Beit HaMikdash, that the Jews knew that they could get forgiveness because of what the Kohen Gadol did in the Beit HaMikdash. What's another holiday where everybody has a responsibility to bring something to the Beit HaMikdash? Okay, Shavuot, Sukkot, I'm thinking of Karban Pesach. I'm thinking of Karban Pesach, which is the only Karban that every single person is responsible to bring for themselves. These two holidays are holidays that were completely Beit HaMikdash focused, and without the Beit HaMikdash, things are a little bit wonky. If you can think of Jews coming up to Yom Kippur, and up until then, they've always fasted on Yom Kippur, but the main focus of what they did was really just based on the avodah that the Kohen Gadol was doing in the Beit HaMikdash, because they knew if he did everything right, he would confess on their behalf, and they would bring karbanot, and he would go into the Kodesh HaKadashim, the holiest place in the whole world, right? And if he did everything right, they would be forgiven for their sins. Now you come up to the first year without a Beit HaMikdash, and you're terrified, right? How are you supposed to get through Yom Kippur without this guarantee of forgiveness, right? Without this toolbox, right? Without the avoda that you know someone can perform on your behalf. So Rabbi Akiva, in the Mishnayot of Masechet Yoma, is quoted as saying something that I believe was incredibly inspirational to those people who are struggling with that. Rabbi Akiva said, we're in the second Hebrew source on page 3, Amar Rabbi Akiva, Ashrecham Yisrael. Rabbi Akiva said, oh, Jews, you are so lucky. You should be so happy. Now, of course, your Beit HaMikdash is destroyed and you're scared for Yom Kippur. You say, Rabbi Akiva, what are you talking about? Why on earth should I feel so happy right now? He says, Lifnei mi atem mitaharin umi mitahar etchem, avicham shebashamayim. Because who is it before you are trying to become clean on Yom Kippur? And who is it who cleanses you? It's your God in heaven. Because the Pasuk says, Shana Amar, V'zarakti aleichem mayim tohorim utahartem. The pasuk in Yechezkel says that God says he himself will sprinkle cleansing water on the Jews. V'omer mikvah Yisrael. And God is also described as the mikvah for the Jews. Ma mikvah mitaharat hatmeim, af HaKadosh Baruch Hu mitaharat Yisrael. Just as going to the ritual bath makes somebody who is impure into somebody who's pure, similarly, God has that power to take the Jews from being impure, bringing them to purity.
You know when this is said, right? Do you know when this paragraph is said? Do you know when this is repeated? When you're doing a tahara.
Oh, really? Okay, I've never been to a tahara.
Word for word.
Really?
Word for word.
Wow.
This is what you say when you're burying.
So I've... No, that's really interesting. That adds another layer to this. Because what Rabbi Akiva is saying to the Jews is that you don't actually need all the shtick. Right? You come to your first Yom Kippur without a Beit HaMikdash, and Rabbi Akiva says, I know you miss the karbanot. I know you miss all of the actions you would do to get yourselves to purity, but if you just open yourself up to being purified by God, that will work. It's not the actions, it's not the sacrifices, it was always just God purifying his nation. And now, without any intervention, without anything physical, still you can achieve that same level of purity. Again, this is Rabbi Akiva seeing a situation in which things are not ideal, and he's explaining why it is that it's not as bad as that. And again, I said Pesach is another holiday that I think would have been particularly depressing for Jews after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And in fact, on Pesach, we saw in the Haggadah a story that's not repeated in the Mishnah or the Gemara or the Tosefta, but that we believe goes very far back, that tells us the story of 5 rabbis who are having the Pesach Seder together. They stayed up all night telling the story of Yitziyah Mitzrayim. Now, anybody, where was that Pesach Seder held?
Bnei Brak.
Bnei Brak. Whose hometown was Bnei Brak? Anybody? Rabbi Akiva. The Gemara tells us... The Gemara tells us that Rabbi Akiva had his court in Bnei Brak, and these rabbis were all coming to Rabbi Akiva for the Pesach Seder. And one explanation that I heard that I think is beautiful is that when suddenly you have a Pesach that's going to look different from any Pesach that you've had before, because you can't bring Karban Pesach and you're feeling kind of down, the person who you want to host you for Pesach Seder is the guy who will say it's okay, is the guy who will say that instead of bringing the Karban Pesach, instead of actually bringing a sacrifice, we'll spend the evening telling the story of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, and through telling the story, we will achieve the same nation-building exercise, we will achieve the same closeness to God that in fact the Karban Pesach was meant to bring us to. So I think in both of these scenarios, we see a way that Rabbi Akiva takes us from the physical service of God into a mode of service of God that actually does not require the Beit HaMikdash. Okay? Yes.
In a sense, he's changed the philosophy of the religion to a more direct relationship between man and God.
Yeah, the relationship needed to find a way to succeed without all the physicality that we were used to. And the next two stories really further cement this idea. And the next two stories tell us about the fact that not everybody really saw things the way Rabbi Akiva did. Right? We're seeing all of this in a very positive way, but it wasn't that everybody lived like this. Okay? The story goes as follows. I'll read along in English.
Which one?
Okay, we're on page 3, where it says Makot 24a. Okay? Everybody, page 3, it says the page numbers at the bottom. Long ago, as Rabban Gamliel, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Yoshua, and Rabbi Akiva.
Wait, where's Rabbi
Tarfon? What? Yeah, we have like a club of rabbis who usually hang out together. Rabban Gamliel was not at that famous Pesach Seder. Rabbi Tarfon is not here. I think Rabbi Tarfon might have been one of the oldest of that club. It's possible that he's died. It's possible he also, had business or he was hanging out with his wife. Right? As we said, it's very important. Rabbis also should go home to hang out with their families. So maybe that's where Rabbi Tarfon was today. Okay? But these rabbis are walking on the road. They heard the noise of the crowds at Rome on traveling from Puteoli, 120 miles away. Okay? They're walking and they hear, this is at the time, basically Rome was occupying the land of Israel. There were Roman troops all over Israel, sort of keeping the peace and extorting taxes from the Jews. And they hear the very, very loud sound of these troops of Rome from a very, very far distance. And they all began to cry. All the rabbis began to cry, but Rabbi Akiva is laughing. Rabbi Akiva, the translation here, it says Rabbi Akiva seemed merry. The Hebrew is Rabbi Akiva Misachek, which can be translated to was physically laughing or just has a happy face on. So you're the rabbis, and you see Rabbi Akiva's in a cheerful mood. What do you say to him?
Why
are you so happy? And Rabbi Akiva says to them, why are you crying? Okay, so there's a little back and forth, but it's pretty obvious why the other rabbis are sad. They said to him, these heathens who bow down to images and burn incense to idols live in safety and ease. But for us, the Beit HaMikdash has been destroyed. The holiest place, the place where we connected to God, it's been burnt down. Of course we should cry, right? How could we not cry? And Rabbi Akiva responds to them, it's for this exact reason that I'm happy. Because I know that the Romans aren't doing what God wants. And they seem to be doing quite well. So us who follow the laws of God, us who are doing what God wants, certainly we will fare better than this. Right? It might not be that we're doing so well right now, but I have faith that we will do just as well, that good things will be coming for us. Now, do you think the rabbis were convinced by this?
No.
We don't hear, but probably not. Right? They probably say, Akiva, you're a dreamer, right? You're saying good things are coming, but right now it's pretty bad. The Beit HaMikdash has been destroyed. The Romans are occupying, right? They're oppressing us. And you say good things are coming, but we don't really know. Okay? So this is a place where we see this Rabbi Akiva saying things must be good, but we don't actually see the good that comes out. But we have another story. Again, this group of rabbis are taking a walk, and this time the ending is a little bit different. Okay? Shuv pam achat hayu olin li Yerushalayim. I'm reading from the bottom of page 3, but you can certainly follow along on the top, in the middle of page 4. The rabbis are walking to Yerushalayim. They're walking up towards Yerushalayim because Yerushalayim is on a hill. Kevan shehigiyu lahar hatzofim karu bigdehem. They got to Har Hatzofim, Mount Scopus, and they tore their clothes. Anybody have a guess? Why is it that when you get to Har Hatzofim, they would tear their clothes?
Yes.
Right. Har Hatzofim is the first place that you could see from there to where the Beit HaMikdash used to be. And it's from there that they, again, are shocked that the Beit HaMikdash is no longer there, and it's there that they tear their clothes. But they go closer. Kevanshi Gila Har Habayit, they were going to visit Har Habayit, where the Beit HaMikdash used to be. What did they see when they get there? Ra'ush Shu'al Sheyatzeh Mibeit Kodshei HaKodashim. They see that a fox is coming out of the Kodshei HaKodashim, the Holy of Holies, the place that, as we mentioned before, only the Kohen Gadol could go, and only on the holiest day of the year, on Yom Kippur. They see that foxes are playing around there. So, knowing the story like we know, what do you think the rabbis begin to do? They cry, and Rabbi Akiva is mitzachek. Hey, we're starting to get a sense of who these people are. And they say to him, of course, why are you laughing? And he says to them, why are you crying? And they say again, and this time they even have a pasuk to support what they're saying. They say, Amrulo, makom shekatubo v'hazar hakarev yumat, v'achshev shualim halchubo v'lo nivkeh. They said the pasuk says that anybody who is not a Kohen, who goes close to the Beit HaMikdash, will die. Right? And now it's a wilderness that foxes can just crawl all over. How could we not cry when we see the holiest place brought down so low? Rabbi Akiva, of course, says, L'kach ani mitzachek. It is for this reason that I am laughing. Right? And he, again, also has psukim here. And this is where things become a little bit different from the previous story. This is a teensy bit complicated, so just hold on. We'll go through it slow. He says, Dichtiv, Va'aita li edim na'amanim et Uriah ha-Kohen v'et Zechariah ben Yivarchiyahu. The pasuk says in Yishayahu that God mentions basically the prophet Uriah and the prophet Zechariah in the same pasuk. Rabbi Akiva says, V'kima inyan Uriah etzal Zechariah. Uriah b'mikdash rishon v'Zechariah b'mikdash sheni. These two prophets lived at completely different times. Why would they be mentioned in the same pasuk? So Rabbi Akiva says, Ella, Talaha Kachuv Nivuato Shel Zechariah b'Nivuato Shel Uriah. The pasuk is trying to tell us that the Nivuah of Zechariah will come true only if the Nivuah of Uriah comes true. Okay, so this is the background. Now we need to know, what are these two prophecies and how is this making Rabbi Akiva laugh? Be'Uriah Ktiv, Lachin Biglachem Tzion Sadeh Techaresh. The pasuk says with Uriah that if the Jews are bad, the Beit HaMikdash will be destroyed and it will be plowed over like a field. The area where the Beit HaMikdash is will become just wilderness. Okay? The Nevuah of Zechariah, B'Zechariah Ktiv, Od Yishvu Zkenim Uzkenot Berchavot Yerushalayim. Zechariah's Nevuah is that Yerushalayim will be rebuilt. And once again, old people will sit in the streets and children will be running in the streets of Yerushalayim and everything will go back as it was. Now here Rabbi Akiva says, Ad shelo nitzkaima nevuato shel Uriah, hayiti mityarei shelo titzkaim nevuato shel Zechariah. While the nevuah of Uriah had not yet been fulfilled, when the Beit HaMikdash had not been completely plowed over, so I was not sure that the nevuah of Zechariah would come true either. Achshav shenitzkaima nevuato shel Uriah, biyadua shenevuato shel Zechariah mitkayamet. Now that I see that the awful prophecy of Uriah has come true, so I have faith that so too the nevuah of Zechariah will come true. Now, do you think the rabbis were convinced of this?
Yes,
because what they say, Belshon Hazeh Amrulo, verbatim, the Gemara says, these are their words, Akiva Nichamtanu, Akiva Nichamtanu. Akiva, you have comforted us. It is finally here that we see that this faith of Rabbi Akiva did have an influence on the other rabbis of his time. He managed to convince them that living in a state of mourning was not going to be effective long term, that they couldn't continuously cry over the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. They had to see the negative things that had happened as precursors to something positive that may be on its way, that may be on its way in a time as yet unknown. Right? He doesn't promise tomorrow we'll see good things. And in fact, when he said, I have faith that good things will happen because good things happen to Rome, the rabbis were not convinced. But when he says, I know that the Nevuah of Zechariah, we have a promise that it will come true at some point, that was enough to convince them. You are comforting us, right? You are right that we can't constantly be crying. Of course, we still have Tisha B'Av, we still cry over the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, but it's true we can't live in a state where we constantly are crying, okay? So this, I think I've hopefully convinced you that this optimism of Rabbi Akiva is, appears in plenty of different places and is obviously something that pushed him and that made him unique among the other rabbis. Hey, Rabbi Akiva was not, was among the top sages of his day, right? Very, very significant. But he wasn't necessarily the Nasir, the Av Beit Din. He wasn't appointed as the president of all the Jews or the head of the, you know, the greatest courts. But he influenced the other rabbis with this positive perspective that he had. Now, in the last couple of minutes, I want to look at something a little bit different, which is the way Rabbi Akiva learned Torah, and to see if Rabbi Akiva's method for learning Torah also might be connected to, somehow to this optimism. Okay? There's a story that's told in Masechet Menachot, which is a story that deserves, you know, more time than we can give it right now, on the bottom of page 4, that says that when Moshe went up to heaven to be taught Torah by God, he saw God tying crowns on the tops of the letters. Okay? I should have put a picture here, I guess. Has anybody seen the way the letters look in a Sefer Torah? The letters in a Sefer Torah have, you know, on the tops of letters, they have little crowns, little points, they have decorations, basically. In this story, Moshe says to God, God, why are you spending so much time decorating the letters? What's the point in all of these little crowns? And God says, one day in the future, there will be a man who will learn things from the fact that I've tied these crowns on the letters. So Moshe says, I want to see him. So they fast forward through time, and God puts Moshe in the back of Rabbi Akiva's classroom. He sees Rabbi Akiva in the front of the class teach halachot based on, you know, very, very specific things in the text, things that Moshe, you know, never saw, never understood from the text, and that's how Rabbi Akiva was teaching his class. And Moshe starts to get depressed, right? Moshe doesn't even understand what's going on, because Moshe knows all the Torah, but he never used these methods of deriving laws from the Torah. So he starts to get kind of upset, until somebody raises his hand and says, Rabbi Akiva, where do you know this law from? And Rabbi Akiva said, this is Halacha LeMoshe MiSinai. This is a law that was taught to Moshe at Sinai, and we know it just through tradition from Moshe. And at that point, Moshe saw that Rabbi Akiva was still, everything he was teaching was still, had its source at what Moshe received at Har Sinai, and he was calmed. Okay? Now, what does it mean that Rabbi Akiva was learning things from the crowns on letters? Okay? Because it happens to be that we don't really, you know, learn particular things from crowns on letters generally. That's not usually the way we learn halacha. So I saw something very interesting from Rabbi Hillel Rahmani, which I found on the VBM website. And he says as follows. We might therefore propose a different understanding of the scene. We're on page 5 now. Rabbi Akiva paid attention not only to the letters themselves, but in his greatness was also able to grasp the depth of every letter in the Torah, and thereby to expand the idea behind it. This is what Chazal meant by saying that he made crowns for the letters. He expanded the letters beyond their apparent proportions, thereby arriving at new laws, the oral law. It is through the in-depth understanding of the letters of the Torah that one is able to illuminate new insights in the oral law, which is the system that connects the Torah to our reality. In order to connect Torah to reality, one has to have a far deeper understanding of it than what appears to us superficially. This is the deeper meaning of the connection between Keter and Malchut, because as we have seen, the deeper perspective of Rabbi Akiva reflects Keter, and it is only through this perspective that there can be innovation in the oral law, which is Malchut. Okay, this is adding some Kabbalah and adding some aspects that have to do with Sfirot and Zohar and things that I'm not totally qualified to teach about necessarily, but the main idea here is every time one steps outside, one needs a deeper and deeper understanding of Torah. And it is through this in-depth study, which is with its attempt to attain the deepest meaning of the Torah, that one is able to connect Torah with reality and to bring the light of Torah into the very physical reality of this world. It is this idea about Rabbi Akiva being able to connect the words of Torah with the reality of the world that we've actually started to see already. If you remember, at the end of the story where Rabbi Akiva learns Torah because of the water in the well, we hear about how Rabbi Akiva started learning Torah. He learned first the alphabet, then he learned Torah, and then when he went to Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua, every time they taught him a halacha, he would go and say, how can I learn that from this letter? You know, these very specific things, how do they teach me these laws? And this is the tradition of Rabbi Akiva, in fact. In all places in Gemara, you very often see students of Rabbi Akiva who learn extra laws based on an extra letter here, an extra letter that there, the fact that it says, you know, it says a word twice, you know, or the fact that we see something spelled a little bit differently. All of these are ways that Rabbi Akiva learned halacha from Psukim in a way that had not been done before. Okay? Now we have the story of the death of Rabbi Akiva. The death of Rabbi Akiva is also a pretty famous story and again reflects a case where Rabbi Akiva brought Torah to life. We're on page 5. We're not going to look at the story inside because we may actually finish on time. So we're not going to look at the story inside, but the pasuk says that we say in Shema. It says, "V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha b'chol vavcha b'chol nafshecha b'chol me'odecha." The pasuk says you should love God with your whole heart, your whole soul, and all of your money. And Rabbi Akiva said that this means you should love God with your whole soul, even if your love for God, even if your faith in God requires you to give up your life. And in fact, this is what happened to Rabbi Akiva. The Romans decreed that you were no longer allowed to learn or teach Torah. His students begged Rabbi Akiva, please stop, you'll get in trouble. Rabbi Akiva said, if we don't learn Torah, we're like fish out of water, and we'll die then too. And he literally uses the example of a fish out of water. Okay? It's actually remarkable. He tells a parable about a fish who tries to escape predators by jumping out of water and certainly dies there as well. Rabbi Akiva says, I'll keep teaching Torah. We'll see what happens. He gets captured. The Romans take him out to kill him. And it's time to recite Kriyat Shema. Okay? It's the morning, and he hasn't said Shema this morning. So as they're torturing him, he's saying Kriyat Shema. And his students say to him, Rebbe Ad Kan, right? They say, even at this awful time in your life, still you have this faith in God, still you're accepting God as your creator as they're torturing you. And he said, if you want to look on page 5, it's the last lines of the underlines in the bottom source. He says, Amar lahem, kol yamai hayiti mitzta'er al pasuk zeh b'chol nafshecha afilu notel at nishmatcha. Rabbi Akiva says, my whole life I was troubled by this verse that tells me that I have to love God with my whole soul, even if it kills me. Amarti mataya volia diva akan menu. He said, when will I ever be able to fulfill this commandment? Ve'achshev shabaliyadi lo akan menu. Now that I have the opportunity to fulfill this commandment, of course now I must be saying Shema. Of course now I must show that my death is for God. Hayam ma'arich be'achad ad shiatzta nishmato be'achad. So he said, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. He emphasized the achad and died as he said it. The point of this is again to see that Rabbi Akiva's explanations of the Torah were not just dry halacha that he, you know, saw the words, said, you know, we do the words. He had a deep understanding that he felt was necessary to actually bring into practice. Finally, we're going to look at just one last source that will tie it all together. It's the same source we saw at the beginning. We're on page 6, the last source, which is, we saw before that Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students who died during this period of Sfira. Now look at the bold. When they died, v'hayaha olam shamem, the world was basically desolate. Now why was the world desolate? We're talking about a time before Torah was written down. Aside from Chumash, no other Torah was written down. The laws of how to actually act were just based on oral transmission from teacher to student and teacher to student. So if Rabbi Akiva had taught 24,000 students and now they were all dead, everything he had taught them was lost, right? All of the energy and all the effort that he had put in for years and years to teach them everything he knew, it was all gone. If I were Rabbi Akiva, to be honest, I would say, that's it, I'm retiring. I did my best. I established yeshivot. I taught students. I did everything I could. But they're all gone now. I can't start again, right? Everything I have, you know what? I'll keep it, you know, for myself. I'm going to go home, spend time with my wife, and that's it. But that's not what Rabbi Akiva did. Ad sheba Rabbi Akiva itzel rabotinu shebidarom. Rabbi Akiva traveled south to find new students. Vishna alahem Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua. V'hem ha'emidu Torah tasha'a. He goes and he finds 5 new students. Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua. And it was through them that Torah was revived during that time. Now, these 5 rabbis, I don't know if they ring a bell to anybody, but these are not just 5 Joe Schmo rabbis. These rabbis literally were the most important rabbis of that next generation. For example, if you open up a Mishnah and you read a Mishnah that doesn't quote any rabbi's name, that Mishnah is in the name of Rabbi Meir. The majority of the Mishnah, it might be said, comes from Rabbi Meir, who was a student of Rabbi Akiva. And everything Rabbi Akiva taught would have been lost if not for Rabbi Meir, who made sure that it was preserved. Similarly, Rabbi Yossi, I'm almost positive, Rabbi Yossi is the father of the Tosefta. When you see things written in Tosefta, that's from Rabbi Yossi, again, a student of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, right? All of the stories about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and everything that he accomplished in terms of teaching Torah to other Jews. Again, all that, only because Rabbi Akiva picked himself up after the tragedy of all of his students dying and said, I'm not giving up yet. I'm going to make sure that Torah continues. And I think this is the perfect example of this optimistic perspective. Right? Rabbi Akiva, on a global perspective, said the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, we can go on. And sometimes it's easy to say it in a global perspective. But when tragedy happened to Rabbi Akiva, when his life's work was destroyed, even then he managed to say, there must be something good that I can take out of that. I will renew my energies and continue teaching Torah. And during Sfirat HaOmer, we have this sort of sad time period, right, where we mourn for the students of Rabbi Akiva, but we're also counting up towards accepting the Torah on Shavuot. And I think that this story really reflects how that works out, right? That sometimes we have setbacks, if it's in our own personal learning Torah or our own personal religious lives, whatever it is, and it's important to mourn. It's important to take time to feel serious and to feel sad and reflect about things that we're not doing as well as we could. But Rabbi Akiva, who's the one who suffered this tragedy, even he wasn't willing to sit still. Even he said, I have to push forward. So I think as we look towards Shavuot, I think that's a message that at least I'm trying to carry with me today. Thank you guys so much for learning with me over the course of this year. I'm really going to miss everyone. I will be back for Shavuot, but we will not be having a Sunday morning Beit Midrash shir. So everybody who manages to come to UOS, I'd love to see you on Shavuot. And oh, and thank you to Annette and Annie for organizing every single week, and for Neda, again, who just coordinates everything that happens when I come here. None of this would happen without you guys, so thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.